Mr. Redding, Duffy versus United States.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Your Honor, I'd like to address this as simply as I can because I think it needs to be. The Duffy's claim in this case asks the court to determine one thing, really. Does the Texas Farm Ventures decision by itself impose 6621C penalty interest? Is it sufficient for the government to rely solely on that to impose the penalty interest? What the claim does not assert is that it is based on an erroneous computation of a computational adjustment necessary to apply the decision. Therefore, it is not a claim that is subject to the six-month statute of limitations. It is not a claim that asserts that the government failed to make a refund that should have resulted from the application of the decision. Therefore, it's not a 6230C1C claim that's subject to 2 years from date of the decision. The appropriate statute of limitations for this claim, I will grant, is somewhat unclear under the code. But there are three possible statutes that apply. It's either 6511, which is the normal 2 years from date of payment statute, or it is the 6230D1 provision at the beginning of that code section that says that the refund cannot be made after the period for assessment expires, but for interest, the period of assessment is 10 years. So we still had, we're well within that period. Or if neither of those apply, then you have to go back to 28 USC 2401, which is the general federal 6 year statute of limitations from the point at which the cause of action accrues. We're clearly within it. I don't think the court needs to address which of those statutes necessarily applies. It only needs to recognize that it is not limited by either the 6230C1 provisions for the six-month or two-year special limitations for certain types of claims, because it is not that type of claim. What we're asking this court to do is determine if the torturous language contained in the decision establishes a clear right for the IRS to assess 6621C, applying the decision as entered, just and applying it under the formula mandated by the regulations to make the attributable to determination, which is exactly what this court did with regard to settled partners in the Wiener case. In that case, under the facts of that case, they found that it was not sufficient, that the settlements were not sufficient. Here we're just asking, was the decision sufficient? The language in that decision is obtuse, to say the least. The operative language here reads that the adjustments to partnership income and expense for the taxable year 1984 are attributable to transactions which lacked economic substance, as described in former IRC Section 6621C3A5, so as to result in a substantial distortion of income and expense as described in IRC Section 6621C8-4 when computed under the partnership's cash receipts and disbursements method. That paragraph contains references to parts of two of the things that are defined as tax-motivated transactions. A substantial distortion of income is one element of one of the defined tax-motivated transactions, which is a disallowance that results from a substantial distortion of income, which results from a proscribed application of an accounting method in the regulations by the taxpayer. This decision makes no reference to any proscribed use of a proscribed method of accounting, nor does it address the ultimate taxpayer. The partnership is not the taxpayer. The ultimate taxpayer is the partner. So it cannot meet that TMT definition. The other part that's referred to is economic substance, lack of economic substance. That is not defined as a tax-motivated transaction in the Code of Regulations.
What else is it?
Sham or fraudulent transaction is defined as a tax-motivated transaction. Nowhere in the motion for entry of decision, the decision, or any of the attachments to the motion. Is the term sham ever used?
Well, now, but, I mean, that's been used for decades, among other things, to describe transactions that lack economic substance and that result in a distortion on a cash basis taxpayer, which your client is, of income and expense. I mean, let me just ask one question. You know, this whole thing is done on a very theoretical level.
Uh-huh.
What were the deductions that were claimed here that were found to lack economic substance?
Well, that's interesting, because the decision does not find that the deductions lacked economic substance. It's kind of convoluted to think about this. What it says is the adjustments are attributable to transactions which lacked economic substance. The adjustments that the assessment is based on are the adjustments to the farming expenses in the decision.
Right, okay.
Okay.
But expenses
now,
are normally deductions, aren't they?
Yes, ma'am. But if I may just go one step further. The only thing the decision says lacked economic substance, that specifically it says lacked economic substance, were a part of the partnership's debt. Now, a cash-basis taxpayer can only take cash deductions for expenses paid in cash. The partnership raised, as found in the decision, raised total capital contributions of it's right here and I can't find it. $3,700,000 and change. It took deductions of over $9 million. Most of those deductions were dependent upon the debt being recognized as legitimate and funds being available to make the cash payments back to the farmers. They were borrowing money from the farmers and theoretically paying it back to the farmers and then taking that as a cash deduction. The decision and the agreement, the only thing it ever says in here that lacked economic substance was the debt. But if the debt lacks economic substance, then the partnership's farm losses cannot be allowed in full. They can only be allowed to the extent that the partnership has either capital contributions or funds from recognized debt sufficient to pay those expenses. And that's, if you go through the math on this thing, that's ultimately what happens. The concept that the farming transactions were shams is itself refuted, if you will, by the very language of the decision, which says, and it's not just an arbitrary numeric adjustment, it says the farm expenses on Schedule F, as reported, were $9 million and change, as determined, $5 million and change. $5 million plus of expenses incurred and allowable to the partnership were acknowledged in the decision.
I know, but when you're in the tax shelter business, which is what this is, I've got some familiarity with this from many years ago. One of the things that you have to do when you do an agricultural tax shelter is you have to be sure that the deductions that you're taking are commensurate with or somehow realistic in terms of the year that you have in front of you. So when you buy cattle feed, for example, in a cattle feeding partnership, you got to buy only so much feed as you're likely to going to be able to use within the reasonable period. And it doesn't say that the cattle feeding operation is bogus. It's not bogus. But if you buy twice or three times as much feed, you can't claim all that as a deduction because it's not realistic in terms of when it's going to be used. And that sounds to me like what you were doing here. You were claiming expenses that far exceeded what was realistic in terms of the scale of the project.
But that is not the same as sham. That is different.
It is.
It's a disallowed deduction. You had the expense. I'm sorry.
Well, it is a sham because the only reason that you're spending an exorbitant amount of money for cattle feed or for whatever the farming expenses were here is to get the tax deduction. It isn't feed or whatever that's
not because the cows are hungry.
not because the cows are hungry. Or, you know, God knows how many generations down the line cows are hungry.
I can agree, Your Honor, and I think we have to come back to Frank Lyons. What is the meaning of sham? What's the distinction here between the various elements? And this court has, in past 6621C cases, looked at it as a two-part test. It's never refined that. It's never absolutely said it's always two-part. But any deduction can be disallowed either because the overall transaction lacks economic substance, which is my Battlestein-type argument in my brief, even though there was bona fide a profit motive, bona fide a business purpose.
Right.
Any transaction can be disallowed, as Copeland in the 6621C case, where the transaction was found to lack profit motive. But the other leg of sham wasn't there. There was no determination that there was lack of economic substance, and this court found the determinations in Krauss and in Copeland were insufficient to support sham. Sham is a very specific term. The code didn't say, and government even could have by regulation said, any transaction which is disallowed for lack of economic substance is a tax-motivated transaction. They haven't.
Well, in this particular case, these deductions lacked economic substance and were tax motivated, and that was the finding. Now, you know, you say, well, that doesn't mean that it's a sham.
Your Honor,
yes, it does.
That wasn't the finding. The finding was only that. If you interpret that paragraph to say that the adjustments were disallowed for lack of economic substance, and that's it, it still doesn't say that there was no business purpose involved. It doesn't say there was no profit motive involved.
It resulted in a distortion. It's tax motivated.
No, ma'am, it does not. There's no mention of tax motivated. Any distortion, any major disallowance of a deduction is going to result probably in a substantial distortion of income. That's a quid pro quo. I mean, one follows the other. You can't have a major adjustment to somebody's tax return that doesn't result in a substantial distortion of their reported net income. But even then, again, go back to the definition that includes substantial distortion of income. That's only a TMT if the substantial distortion results from a proscribed application of an accounting method by the taxpayer. Those elements are not satisfied here. You can't take pieces of two different TMTs and amalgam them together and say it is sufficient to meet either definition. And the real question is, what did Congress mean when they said sham? I'll add that they put it in the same sentence as fraud. It's something higher than simply a disallowance for lack of profit motive. And in fact, in the code and in the regulations, I think it's clear that that is recognized too, because one of the other TMTs that was addressed in Copeland is a transaction disallowed under Section 183 for lack of profit motive. But in Copeland, the disallowances were under 165 for lack of profit motive, not under 183, and therefore it couldn't be a TMT. It didn't meet the definition. Here, we come down to a very serious definitional question. What is sham? Is it something more? And I submit that it is an amalgam of both lack of economic substance to the transaction and lack of a profit motive or business purpose. And there was no finding here of the lack of profit motive or business purpose.
I don't agree with you.
Well,
I think you have to find a lack of profit motive. I mean, for the overall transaction in which the taxpayer's partnership is engaged, I think what you've got here is you claim too much of a deduction that was not realistic in terms of what the partnership was likely to do or engage in.
Your Honor, there's not even that determination. Because if these contracts with the farmers for planting $5 million worth of crops are interpreted to be valid, which they're not challenged here, and the crop sales are recognized at their full face value in the second year, which they were, the question becomes, was the contract with the farmer simply an assumption of risk, or did they in fact pay cash as a cash method taxpayer?
Of course, all that's been decided.
No, ma'am, it hasn't. It was never addressed. I'm sorry, but it really has not.
Worse.
Pardon?
I guess that's worse.
It would. That it hasn't been decided? I think not. I think what it means is that the elements necessary to establish sham haven't been determined. And if you can't make that determination from the TEFRA partnership level proceedings or subsequent determinations as to the partner, then you can't apply 6621C. That's all. The disallowance of the deductions are fine. And I think a lot of convolution about what is sham comes about because many of the cases where the term sham is used, and I say lightly, are cases of disallowance only, not a question of, is it really a sham? Because if you fail either leg of sham, the deduction cannot be recognized and is disallowed. There's no question about that. But for it to be a sham, something that was, I think, initially created in Frank Lyon by the Supreme Court, which talks about lack of economic substance and lack of business purpose or profit motive, the second leg has never been established here. In Wiener at the trial court.
Do you want to save some time for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well then you better.
Ma'am, I'll make one quick.
All right.
Just to finish that point. And that is that one of the things this court has stepped around in the past 6621C cases is whether or not the profit motive test is partner level or partnership level. Here it doesn't matter because it's not been determined at either level. Thank you, Your Honor.
One thing you need to focus on, Mr. Catterall, because I just don't get it. I'm out of my league, is this statute of limitations question and the jurisdictional issue. So if you could start out with that and then hit the rest of it, that would be useful.
May it please the court. My name is Arthur Catterall. I'm an attorney with the Justice Department representing the government in this case, and I will start with although I think this is most easily viewed through the lens of res judicata, I'll go ahead and address the jurisdictional question. Section 7422H operates as a bar against refund claims that are attributable to partnership items. Now, in this context, there are two ways or two avenues out of Section 7422H for a partner who has a refund claim that stems from a partnership-level proceeding. The first category is a claim that is attributable to a non-computational adjustment that is unique to the partner. Some courts have called this a substantive affected item. I think that language is a little bit loose and has been used loosely by the courts. But that's the key, is that it's a non-computational determination that is unique to the partner. In this case, regardless, I mean, there's a lot of back and forth as to whether is this really computational or non-computational. Regardless of how that issue goes, it is clear that this claim is not unique to these taxpayers. This is something that they are attacking the partnership level determination, and that affects the applicability of the tax motivated interest to every partner in this partnership. So it's not unique to these partners. And so we argue that category or that avenue out of 7422H.
Now, does it have a statute number?
I'm sorry?
That avenue that you're talking about, which section of the code is that?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a lot of TEFRA provisions regarding, you know, what's an affected item and what needs what kind of deficiency can be assessed right away as opposed to requiring a notice of deficiency. And I mean, there's somewhat of a parallel between, in other words, although it doesn't completely jibe in this case because it's interest, but as a general matter, if the IRS, if you have a partnership proceeding and In order to apply the results of that proceeding to a particular partner, there you have to make, if the particular item you're looking at requires non-computational factual determinations unique to that partner, the IRS can't just assess the resulting tax. They have to issue a notice of deficiency like any other individual tax case. And those are typically the situations where, okay, if you have that situation, and then again, the partner would have the choice of either going to tax court or paying and suing for a refund. And in that situation, that sort of loosely describes this first category I'm talking about.
Okay.
Well, I'm missing your answer, so maybe I'm the only one. But you had an alternative argument that the taxpayers here did not file their claim within a two-year statute of limitations under 6230 or whatever. And I'm not clear whether you made that argument below or not. So kind of in a declarative sentence, would you say whether or not the government is asserting that the claim by the Duffys was untimely? I know you want to argue res judicata and the rest of it, but do you argue that it was untimely under the 2 years? And if so, as succinctly as possible, why that is the case? And if that's the case, do we get to the rest of it? And when you finish that, you can go on otherwise.
All right. It is, we are arguing that it is untimely under that 2 year statute under section 6230C. That statute applies to claims, I don't know the language exactly, but claims that are necessary to apply the terms of either a settlement agreement, an uncontested FPAA, Notice of Final Partnership Administrative Adjustment, or a judicial proceeding to that partner. And the statute of limitations that applies to that kind of claim is it's 2 years from the date of whichever is applicable, the settlement agreement, the uncontested FPAA, or the date the judicial decision becomes final. In our case, we have a judicial decision that became final, I believe, 3 months after it was entered in July of 2001, so that became final, I guess, in October 2001. So that two-year statute under 6230C starts running in October of 2001, goes to October 2003, and these taxpayers filed their refund claim after that period. So yes, we are arguing that that two-year statute.
Why so little devoted to that argument if that's the trump card?
Well,
if that's true, does that not make everything else disappear, or what am I missing?
Well, in my mind, this, I mean, obviously, TEFRA is a morass, and it's there are a lot of moving parts, and there are a lot of issues as, you know, what does attributable to mean? What does computational mean? I mean, there's a lot of issues, and it seems to me that the easiest way to dispose of this is through the res judicata argument, and so I think that's why we emphasize that first, because that to me seems a little more intuitive. TEFRA is.
Probably slower than some, but I'm never going to figure that it's easier to unravel res judicata, i.e., what was argued, than it is to having a defendant point on the counter saying this happened here, this happened there, and this was filed after that, and it's over. Now, to me, the shortest distance between 2 points is a straight line. So to me, if it is as you say, that to me is simple. I mean, if you had a moving target in terms of when something was filed and all that, I get it. But if you say the point of departure is a judicial ruling, you know, that's certain. That occurs on a given date. Now, their argument might be that ruling didn't encompass this or whatever, whatever. So it may not be as simple as I'm saying. But that's why I wanted to at least tee it up to see if you're saying there's a ruling here, it embraced all of this. Time period ends in October 03, they're filing, and that tees it up. Council officers can come back to say, no, we're not out of the box because, but I just want to be clear if the government, A, is asserting that, because jurisdiction isn't waived, and if it's there, we have to deal with it. But, you know, if we've got your argument on that, I don't mean to tie you up from the other argument.
No, and
I don't get it. You made this argument to the district court?
I don't believe we made the two-year argument, the two-year argument under Section 6230C. I believe in the district court we just argued the six-month statute under 6230C. And our point is, I mean, we believe that that a strong case can be made that the six-month statute applies, but the salient point here is that regardless of whether it's the six-month or the two-year statute under 6230C, they failed to satisfy either statute. So obviously in our briefs we didn't take a strong position as to whether it's the six-month or the two-year that applies because they lose under either. So. And on the point on res judicata, I agree that in most cases it's a very thorny issue, but here we've got a little bit of a special situation. We've got this agreed decision, and when you have an agreed decision, the preclusive effect for purposes of res judicata is determined by what the parties to the underlying partnership-wide settlement agreement intended. And here we've got, this settlement agreement that was attached to the motion for entry of decision. We've got a provision that specifically says, the partners will be estopped from contesting 6621C interest, subject to their rights under Section 6230C. So it seems clear that the intent of the parties was that these agreed decisions are conclusive on the issue of tax-motivated interest, subject to whatever rights you may have under Section 6230C. And the point here is, even if these claims are described in one of these provisions in Section 6230C, they would not be timely. So that closes off that avenue. So I agree that the res judicata is not cut and dried, but I think it's more so in this kind of case where you have an agreed decision. You've got the parties saying here's what we intend to happen. Here's what we intend the effect of these decisions to be. So I think that's why we stressed the res judicata aspect of it.
Well, am I wrong? Isn't this jurisdictional? Isn't this statute of limitations issue jurisdictional?
It is, and I understand that
the district court has to address that then.
Right, and I understand that normally that's what you lead with is the jurisdictional argument, and again I think that the thought is that the jurisdictional argument and is so enmeshed with TEFRA, and it's such. There's a lot of sort of open issues in the case law about this. If we could provide a more concrete reason for the district court to dismiss these claims, why not go that route so that they could, even assuming that they had jurisdiction, the claim would still be barred by res judicata.
Trouble is, Judge Rosenthal didn't address this, the 2-year statute issue, did she? I don't recall.
No.
See, and we don't have the benefit of what she thought on it.
Well, I think, again, the point is the only avenue out of 7422H here is 6230C, and it doesn't matter whether it's the six-month statute under Section 6230C or the two-year statute under Section 6230C, because the claim was untimely under either one of them.
But it must be something wrong with your statute of limitation argument, because I just don't remember seeing a situation in which if you got a gut cinch on no jurisdiction, why in the world one want to wind through the park on all these other issues unless it's purely academic? I mean, Judge Rosenthal is a sharp judge, yeah. And I don't understand the government didn't tee up jurisdiction first off, even if you got these other alternative arguments, but to say, well, we kind of argued 6 months below and we kind of argued 2 years, but, you know, here's this other deal. I mean, it's kind of laying in the weeds here. And I just had this feeling that when counsel gets up, he's going to blow the 2 year out the water, and maybe we're missing something. But jurisdiction is jurisdiction. So I just don't
we
get
have
to
address
conceding jurisdiction so you can get an answer on all this other esoteric stuff.
I mean, we have to address it. She had to address it.
Right, right. And
she did.
Well, he didn't raise it.
Well, no, I mean, we didn't argue the 2 year statute, but I mean, again, the point is, in order to the reason she addressed the 6 month statute is because she concluded that if there's any way around the bar of 7422H, it's a claim under Section 6230C.
But you're the government. You're coming from the tax division. I guarantee you, as an individual taxpayer, if you had me dead to rights on statute of limitation on my refund, you'd be saying, sorry, too late, you know, to get the claim. I mean, I don't get it with the Department of Justice Tax Division, you know, not the local U.S. attorney, coming in here on one of these claims. If you got this shot out of the water on statute of limitations, I just don't understand how that's a tertiary argument that's kind of soft-pedaled, by the way, you know, here's 6 months, and put the district court through all these permutations on dealing with TEFRA and understanding all this intricate stuff, which is interesting, but it's not the daily fodder. If it's really barred under statute of limitation, I'm speaking only for myself, I know that I'm missing something. And we get parties who don't want to talk about jurisdiction, but I don't get the United States government tax division, if that's lead pipe, why that didn't lead in. It's not waivable. I mean, you know those boilerplate precepts. So not criticizing you, but something's tugging on me that I must be missing something, you know, about this.
Again, cases have been kind of all over the board on the issue of jurisdiction for TEFRA-based refund suits. And as taxpayers have pointed out, there's a couple of cases, I believe one in the Southern District of Texas and another maybe Northern, where the district court held that the six-month statute didn't apply, and basically concluded that the regular, you know, 2 years from date of payment or 3 years from filing the return statute applied. So, you know, you've got these cases all over the board, and I'm I hesitate to speak for the trial attorney, but I think it seems so clear. The res judicata point seems so clear, I think that's why we led with it. Whereas anything associated with TEFRA, whether it's jurisdictional or not, is a mess. And it's a work in progress. And, you know, I think taxpayers.
I get your point. This is the last thing I'm going to say on this. If you get a situation where you lead with no jurisdiction, the trial court rules on that, but says, if I'm wrong about that, then goes on all the other claims. Then we get a record up here where the district court has addressed jurisdiction subject matter. We review it. If we agree, case is out. If we say no, wrong, then we got the rest of the case. That's different from not asserting a statute of limitations bar straight up in the below where the court addresses it and then going on to other audit just because strategically and prudentially it seems like there's another way to get out. It's different if it wasn't jurisdiction. I get that. But that's the point that is just eluding me, how it's because it's jurisdictional, it's not asserted out. And I'll leave that alone.
I'm sorry, it's not what?
Well, anyway, I'll leave it alone. I'm repeating myself. I just don't understand the process that, you know, occurred here, given this tax division.
I mean, you could easily say, if I had only known that so much discussion would center around this point, I would have addressed it, Your Honor, on appeal. me.
Well, again, I mean, we did make the jurisdictional argument below. Necessarily, that argument is predicated on the idea that this claim is would be under Section 6230C. And we just focused on the six-month statute, granted. But and I think we added the two-year in our appellate brief just to make the point that it doesn't matter whether the six-month statute applies under 6230C or the two-year statute applies under 6230C. The claim was untimely in any event.
Okay.
I'll touch just briefly on the merits, which the district court, you know, in the course of its discussion of res judicata and the jurisdictional issues, actually did address the merits of these claims, and we submit rightfully rejected them. The idea that sham does not, or lack of economic substance as described in the, you know, the 6621C3A5 somehow does not equate to
a sham.
Sham is beyond.
I mean, my sense of I actually many years ago worked for the tax division for one summer, so there was no big issue. But the summer was spent on sham transactions, and I got the impression that it was a term that was used very broadly to cover a whole lot of stuff. And I sort of have that sense here. But lack of economic substance has got to be the classic sham transaction.
So, well, what do you say that it means then? I mean, that's, we're saying there's no definition to it. It's some kind of amorphous
term. Is.
Well, and I think this court recently in the Klamath case clarified this a little bit and said basically a lack of objective economic substance is sufficient to disregard a transaction for tax purposes.
Is it sham?
I'm sorry?
Is it sham?
Yeah. In fact, the court in Klamath, you know, in one part of their opinion, they referred to lack of economic substance, and then in another section of the opinion, when they were dealing with whether expenses were deductible, you know, advisory fees and things like that, it talked in terms of sham. So we submit that the two are...
Sham really is a loosely applied term that really has no meaning.
Well, and I will say this. There are shams in substance.
A variety of meanings. It depends on... Well, for example, the thing that I was involved in was subchapter C, which is completely different than this, but it was a term that was used there too. And, I mean, it's used all over the place to describe a series of... But, I mean, it certainly seems to me it would describe... a transaction that lacked economic substance. That's sort of the classic sham.
Yeah, and that's a sham in substance. There's also a sham in fact when, you know, the supposed transactions just never took place. And, you know, so there is, it's not a complete overlap, but certainly lack of economic substance and substantive sham are the same thing.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Redding.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to quickly say the statute of limitations issue is critical because at this time the government has now withdrawn from the settlements of all of the settled partner cases that are still pending in the Southern District, where we'd settled about half of them based on Wiener, and now the government is coming back and saying, oh, well, maybe this six-month statute of limitations applies even to those cases for the settled partners. It doesn't, Your Honor, because the two-year statute that he is referring to applies only to claims based on the argument that, and I quote, the Secretary failed to allow a credit or to make a refund to the partner in the amount of the overpayment attributable to the application of the partner of a settlement, final decision, et cetera. That only applies where the taxpayer is saying that final result in the TEFRA proceeding should have produced a refund to me that the government didn't pay me. You've got 2 years to file that from the time of the settlement or the decision. That's not the issue here. They're saying the government in its own brief says there are two tests applied at the partner level. Was it attributable to a sham or a TMT,
and was it over $1,000? We're saying that the test of whether or not it was attributable to a tax-motivated transaction was not properly applied, the partner-level test that the government's own brief admits is a partner-level test. That says look at, just as you did in Wiener, the operative document and see if it is sufficient to support 6621C. That is not a claim under either of those two 6230C descriptions of claims. It's a generic claim. It's a claim based on a failure of the government to do something properly after the tax court decision was entered. And our position is they failed to properly apply the decision. As to the res judicata effect, Your Honor, I pointed out, just, you know, we've done it in a brief, but this was an agreed decision. There is contract interpretation. Judge Rosenthal did, in her opinion, find that it was not the intent of the parties to preclude the partners from challenging 6621C. The question is, what could they challenge? We don't challenge the language, the content of the decision. That is not the challenge. The challenge is, was it properly applied? And that we still have a right to do. There have been several cases that have come out where something similar has happened in CDP cases, where there was no adequate determination of a TMT. Could 6621C be challenged post-assessment? And the answer has been yes. The issue should come down to, what does this court interpret that paragraph to mean under general contract principles, because it's an agreed decision. And I know your feeling on this, Your Honor, but I come back to...
Well, you don't have to worry about my feeling.
Well, I mean, I know your interpretation of this, but I ask you to take a hard look at it. Sham has a history of development. And in most cases, even cases where it's used loosely, they usually talk about both lack of economic substance, lack of profit motive, or lack of business purpose. There has to be both to be a sham. Klamath, for example, is a disallowance case. It didn't matter. As long as lack of economic substance or lack of profit motive was present, the deductions are disallowed. In Copeland, it didn't matter. Lack of profit motive, deductions disallowed, but not the tax-motivated transactions. There was no finding of lack of economic substance. There was no other finding that would support an element, a defined. These are terms being used to apply a very severe penalty. The 6621C portion of the interest in this case was 500% of the tax. And those definitions, and the code does not define sham, did not define sham. At the time, the pending law that was out there in 2001 made it very clear that there was a tremendous dispute as to what the meaning of sham was. The government and the TMP were well aware of the pending Wiener litigation, where we were arguing that sham is a two-part test. We argued both that it shouldn't have been applied as a matter of law because of the multiple grounds, but we also argued that it was a two-part test, which Judge Atlas agreed with and actually tried Dr. Wiener's personal profit motive. The general analysis in this court in the past has looked at, has reserved the question of whether profit motive had to be addressed at the partner level or the partnership level. There's about a lot of litigation about that. Here it doesn't matter because the determination was not made in either case. There's no determination anywhere that the investor lacked a profit motive. There's no determination that the farming transactions as a whole were not entered into with a profit motive, or even that the loan agreements weren't entered into with a profit motive. They lacked economic substance under the tax law to allow a deduction based on the supposed funds that were transferred by check exchange. I'm sorry.
Okay, I think we have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.